Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban.
We are here today on July 8th, and there's a lot to talk about. There always is. It seems week by week, there's so many developments in this industry. It's just fascinating. And of course, today is kind of a special day because the FDA finally released a report. They're about a month late. The Senate Appropriations Bill in December of 2019 stipulated that they had 6 months to release some findings on CBD. Of course, everybody you talk to, we see it on the Hoban Minute again and again and again, brings up the FDA. We're waiting on the FDA. The FDA is ultimately kind of the last block now that we have the USDA on board. They are the federal regulatory agency that this is all hinging upon. And of course, we had Hoban Law Group attorney Garrett Graff in here earlier to give a little update on this. But I want to hone in on two things with you right now. The report that they submitted basically said, we're going to dig deeper into CBD products that are either A, mislabeled, or two, adulterated. And mislabeled, I think we all understand. This is something we talked about even today with Mary Biles today earlier on the Hoban Minute. And the point is that a lot of studies have showed that the what is advertised on the bottle usually is not entirely representative of what's actually in the bottle with respect to milligrams. But we understand mislabeling. I think that kind of covers that. But I want to talk about adulterated. Give us a sense, if you would, on what the FDA is trying to say in this report with respect to adulteration of CBD products.
Great point. Let's get to adulteration, but let's not just gloss over this idea of labeling and representations on a bottle or a package. That's a critical component here because at the end of the day, what's the problem with companies that have put aggressive labels on their products? They represent that those products do a particular thing, cure, treat, address a specific health condition. Those things, while they might be true based on experience, are things that can't go on packaging. So it's the claims element of this that I think the FDA is concerned most about versus the idea that the packaging needs to be done better. We need guidance as an industry from the FDA to determine whether that package should have food nutritional facts or supplement facts in terms of what the fact panel that's standardized on every product has on it, what it tells us, what it does. And until we know that, it's hard to create 100% accurate packaging. However, the claims issue is something that is paramount. Now, talk about toxicity. And this was perhaps the biggest disappointment, if there was disappointment, from what was transmitted from the agency to the White House today, as I understand it. All right. The idea was we were hoping to see something that reflects the fact that they've done safety studies, toxicity studies about cannabinoid CBD products in particular or other oils in the marketplace. To do and to validate what the industry largely knows, that most manufacturers are doing the right things, regulated at the state level, and are producing products that are of a consumer-grade quality. And that's the thing I think that was most disappointing to most in the industry. They didn't see that validation of, yes, this is safe. They're waiting for that because that's a major step forward. And that goes right to the adulteration issue. Until that's established, it's hard for the FDA to say, here's what you got to do to become licensed and to participate properly in this either supplement or food or supplement and or food type scenario. So that's the kind of stuff that we're waiting for. And it does mark good progress that during a pandemic, work continues to move forward on something that's so vital to so many people in our industry, this industry, which, you know, is not exactly center stage given what's going on in the world.
Excellent point. And anytime the FDA says the word CBD, it's a huge point of celebration and analysis for this industry. And I'm sure more will come. But Garrett raised some great points just as far as the actual substance of this report. Definitely tune into that. But let's shift gears a little bit. And I want to kind of highlight something we talked about today on the podcast, which is, and I promise there's a bigger topic in mind here, but just as a way to segue into it, here in the United States, we are moving towards a system, and we've talked about this a lot, Bob, that allows for some amount of THC in these products, in CBD products, otherwise known as full spectrum. However, in a country like Britain and in the European Union, they are moving towards a regulatory system that just completely removes THC. And I want you to talk about perhaps some of the challenges that are going to arise from having two major players as far as global commerce and global trade coming at this from two very different regulatory stances.
Yeah, so you make a good point, and it's something that not a lot of people focus on because it's really early in the development of what we consider a global industry. But there's a significant enough international exchange as it relates to cannabinoid products that we should be paying attention to these things. So our federal law talks about Delta-9 THC, 0.3% for industrial hemp. The wisdom is that the FDA further validates that 0.3% standard for finished goods, whether that's retail products that go on, you know, topicals, ingestibles, so forth and so on, food products. The rhetoric thus far has not been that somehow, some way, we're going to make THC completely illegal. In fact, our law says the complete opposite of that. It takes THC off of the controlled substance if it's derived from industrial hemp. So that's an important thing to think about here. So it's likely that our FDA rules place hemp derivatives, hemp compounds, in a food or supplement lane, probably both, at which point you've got to look at the cannabinoid content, you've got to look at what's in place, and distinguish that from some of the other lanes. And if you look at what that finished good should or could contain, it's probably going to have some semblance of THC in it. Well, the European Union standard is very different. They've designated that cannabinoids, CBD in particular, are novel foods, meaning they've never been introduced into the food supply chain. So you got to go through safety studies, so forth and so on, before you can introduce that as an ingredient in a product. So you're almost creating two different systems in this industry that are so powerful in terms of consumer population in what is a nascent industry. Doing very, very, very different things. If our FDA says food and supplements, sure, go for it. Full, broad spectrum products, including THC up to a threshold, probably 0.3% THC, no more, no less, or less, but no more. And the standard that's based in Europe that says zero THC, I mean, you start to create inequities and the inability for a global business to develop. And that's really the beauty of what's going on around us. If you just look at one little slice of it, it's impactful and it's interesting and it's remarkable progress. But if you look at it from a global perspective, this stuff can have a major impact around the world. And I just think people are blind to it.
That's exactly the point I'm trying to get to, which is the how you're going to align all of these different countries into a unified global policy. And I'll ask you this, and not to get into the weeds on this, Bob, but of course, we're talking about the U.S. with a 0.3% threshold. Now, based on some of the conversations we had today with folks who are in the United Kingdom, it sounds like they're trending towards a 0% THC threshold. We've talked a lot about Europe as having a 0.2 threshold, although that kind of seemed to be in question with some of the folks we talked to today. The point being here, now we have folks in the United States talking about a 1% threshold. And I'll just put it to you like this, not to get into the weeds on this issue. Do we need 1%? Is it absolutely vital to the development of the industrial hemp industry here in the United States, as many people would argue that it is? Or do you think that we can get that development of the hemp industry with 0.3%?
Let me start by saying this, Eric. It's a topic that has been subject of much debate at the USDA level, at the international level, in terms of the arbitrary nature of that standard. But fundamentally, farmers should get what farmers want. Farmers illustrate the backbone of the global food supply chain, no matter what they produce. So if farmers think 1% gives them more opportunity, and they've done that, then they should get what they want. But as a public policy matter, I don't believe that it actually helps further the United States industrial hemp industry. And here's why. Because by increasing the threshold delta-9 THC percentage to 1%, on a total THC basis, given what we're doing now, maybe that makes some sense. But what it seems to do is it seems to create a scenario that furthers the production of individualized cannabinoids. And we've talked about this at length. Even when cannabinoids are mainstream ingredients, it doesn't take a lot of industrial hemp that's highly specialized in terms of its yield for cannabinoid production to produce what the biggest companies in the world need. So there's just not that huge of a market for the biomass to the extent of cannabinoid production only. So increasing things to 1%, unless you could use a 1% THC designation to also produce multi-purpose crops, or crops that were just so dynamic that they protected farmers, that they allowed farmers to participate in multiple revenue streams. But if it just continues to promulgate this notion that we need to focus on high cannabinoid genetics, to me, that's, if you're using 1% to let farmers do that, then you're just, you know, perpetuating a flawed business model, because the supply and the demand for cannabinoid products either doesn't exist, or when it will exist might come from other sources. And at the end of the day, it just doesn't require that much biomass to get enough high quality products for people that grow specialized high cannabinoid.
Well, everything that you're saying reminds me of something we've seen almost across the board in the hemp industry, which is that we've let the focus on cannabinoids dictate the policy and just the entire paradigm around it, which is you really don't need a 1% threshold if you're thinking about all of the other uses. When you're really focused on cannabinoids, and I'm not an agronomist, I'm not pretending to know a ton about actual plant genetics and everything else.
But a metric ton or a U.S. ton?
Good distinction.
A farmer would want to know that.
But the more you want to push that cannabinoid production for a compound like CBD or CBG is when you get into a riskier terrain around pushing a cannabinoid like THC. Whereas if you're just growing for grain or you're growing for fiber, that's less of a concern. So it does. It seems like that whole movement. But here's the point. I promised that we were going somewhere bigger, and that's where I want to go now, which is we just highlighted the distinction between full spectrum here in the United States and whatever they're doing in Europe around kind of removing THC. But let's talk about what came out not too long ago, which is that the European Industrial Hemp Association is interested, at least preliminarily, in creating a global hemp association. There are hemp associations all over the place. You know this well. You go and speak at these places, Bob. There's the EHIA, or AHIA. I'm not going to pretend to pronounce that acronym correctly, but there's the HIA here in the United States. There is the Latin American Hemp Industries Association that just came to fruition here in the last couple months. So you have all these different country or continent bodies who are trying to represent the interests of the farmers, the supply chain in their jurisdictions, basically for lobbying efforts or for other things that trade associations do. And now you have an interest in actually creating a global body, one that's going to approach global policymakers at the United Nations, the World Health Organization, perhaps even something like the International Monetary Fund, to speak on hemp policy. And here's my question to you. How in a reasonable way. And this is, you've traveled all over the world. You've seen perhaps more than anyone else the patchwork and the puzzle that is the global hemp industry. How do you align all of these different countries that are at different stages of their development to actually create an international body that's going to be able to communicate to these global policymakers what the heck are the needs of the global hemp industry? Mr. Hoban.
The importance of global cooperation has never been more paramount. When you think about products that are going into the marketplace intended for widespread distribution for human consumption, enriched with cannabinoids, which, yes, they have certain benefits, and yes, we know as a general rule that these things are safe, but the data that the agencies require has not been submitted through the proper channels to date. That, at a minimum, is a reason that international organizations involving hemp should get together and try to work together.
Let me just finish with one more question, Bob, which is, we see different THC thresholds around the planet. Is it important in your mind for there to be a universal threshold, whether it's 1%, 0.3, or any other number that you can come up with? And at the end of the day, and I do want to kind of highlight this point, it's arbitrary. You know, we have determined that cannabis with a THC amount that really is not in the 5 to 10% range, particularly when you look at the kind of marijuana strains that exist here in Colorado that are pushing 20, 25, 30% THC, we could have probably a lot of different numbers that we agree upon. But I just want to put it to you, what is it important for there to be a universally agreed upon THC threshold?
Here's a Colorado tidbit that you need to understand as a background to this. And this is important because it goes to THC threshold. In 2018, our law firm led a number of state legislature initiatives on behalf of our clients. One of the things we successfully were able to pass, thanks to the leadership and the skills of Garrett Graff helping us get it done, was a simple piece of legislation that says if the federal government changes the THC threshold for the definition of hemp from 0.3 to something else, then Colorado would follow. So if it went up, it went up. If it went down, I suppose to its detriment, if I recall correctly, it certainly would track that. My point is this: universal THC threshold. It depends what creates the advantages or the disadvantages in the marketplace. We've talked about this. We talked about it tonight. Does an increased THC threshold increase opportunities for farmers and business owners, or decrease the competition or the interest of those folks? That is not a black and white answer. It's just not. You have to look at data. You have to look at market trends to understand very specifically what's the right way to proceed there. So, 1% countries. If the U.S. doesn't change its 0.3% standard for THC, does that mean that the material produced in those countries is actually determined to be marijuana because it's above 0.3% and therefore those goods cannot be transmitted and sold in interstate commerce, even if they're non-psychoactive, or even if they're just terpenes or stock? That still comes from a marijuana plant, although there's some exceptions under federal law for the stock. But to get into that is a tricky thing. Does there need to be? No. I think every jurisdiction should pick what's in its best interest by way of THC percentage, so that they can either gain an advantage if they see one, or take a very, you know, singular approach to how they would participate in this industry if they create a strain or a genetics or a standard that benefits them directly and nobody else, frankly, wants. That's what the market does. But in this case, the market are international governments participating in the hemp industry, and that's pretty darn exciting to be a part of.
Yeah, that's something that is an absolute first. Well, Bob, just to wrap this episode up, if you enjoyed this episode or any episode of the Hoban Minute, please give us a follow at the Hoban Law Group on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our newsletter Every week, we're putting out all of this information around what's going on in different countries, regions, what's going on here in the United States. There are developments, as we just said at the beginning of this episode, every week by week, there's so much to talk about because so many things are happening, and the Hoban Law Group is always one of the first to comment on it and give a perspective that is global and highlights the policy, legal, and regulatory aspects that ultimately are going to shape what the global cannabis industry looks like. So for all of us here at the Hoban Law Group, Bob, it's always a pleasure, man.
Likewise, my friend. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.